The Psychoanalysis Podcast explores the ways that horror movies examine mental health issues. It deals with mature and sometimes disturbing subject matter, and it may not be suitable for all listeners. It is meant for entertainment purposes only, and not as a substitute for proper therapy. If you or a loved one are currently experiencing mental health difficulties, please contact your local mental health center.
Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out.
Breathe in.
Breathe out.
This is Psychoanalysis.
This is Psychoanalysis, a horror therapy podcast analyzing the horror genre through the lens of mental health. I'm Jen Adams.
I am Mike Snoonian.
And Laura is unfortunately not feeling well tonight, but she will be back with us next week. But we are joined by a familiar voice today. You may remember him from, I'm sorry, I got in my head about my Troy McClure voice. You might remember him from Podslake, our episode on Mulholland Drive. And here to talk about another David Lynch mindfuck is the host of the Dead Letter Movie Podcast, Andrew. Hey, Andrew, welcome
back. Hi, thanks for having me again.
Yeah, we're so excited. I am excited for you to explain this movie to me also. this is a comfort horror episode, and we define comfort horror as the scary movies that bring us joy or bring us comfort in some way. I realize they don't always bring us joy, but they always bring us at least some kind of soothing, comforting feeling.
We're going to be doing one soon that brings me zero joy.
I know. Yeah, we just decided to do one that brings me a lot of, gory anxiety, but it'll be fine. It'll be great.
Choice, like, do you want to get like hit in the head with a frying pan or kicked in the balls? Like, you
right.
know,
that would. I'd probably rather get kicked in the balls because I don't have them. So
true.
You know, just for the record, but that's personal preference. So the movie that we're talking about today, Andrew, what did you choose?
This is Blue Velvet from 1986.
Sweet.
I guess it's not the movie that made David Lynch like a big, like, I think The Elephant Man was probably like what made him a critical darling after Eraserhead. Eraserhead being like a big cult movie for a lot of, so that audience knew who he was. But this is like his real becoming of like a big critical thing. This was after Dune didn't do so well.
This is the one that I think of, I think, when I think of David Lynch. Yeah. You know, this and Mulholland Drive are the ones. And I say that as a person who's not super familiar with him. So this is kind of my, you know, I don't want to say it's a cliche movie when I think about him, but this is the one that I think is most, for non-Lynch heads, is like, I don't know. I might just back out of everything I'm saying.
Yeah, this is, if someone like asked me if they wanted to like get into his movies and weren't quite ready for Mulholland Drive, this would be the movie I would recommend because, unlike Eraserhead, which is often a gateway point for some people, that's like, this one is fairly easier to understand. It still has a lot of that weirdness, but it still kind of has a pretty regular mainstream crime movie plot going. It's like, I think last time we kind of did a comparison with John Waters. And how, like, you know, you may have, someone wants to get into John Waters movies, maybe they liked Hairspray, but they aren't sure they're ready for Pink Flamingos. This would be Polyester, basically.
Oh, that's a good comparison. Yeah, I like that. But before we start talking about Blue Velvet, we are going to give a brief synopsis in case you haven't seen the movie, or it's been a while, or like me, you're still not quite sure exactly what everything means. Although I agree with you, this one is a little more straightforward than Mulholland Drive. So here is your spoiler warning. And let's see if I can pull off my Dennis Hopper voice. To your spoiler! Or to your fucking spoiler.
I was
going to
say, baby wants the spoiler.
I love spoilers. All right. So we open on an idyllic neighborhood with flowers, white picket fences, fire truck Dalmatians, and nicely kept lawns. But there's trouble in paradise. A man watering his lawn has a tragic accident and falls into a mud puddle. Deep within the grass, beetles are feasting on something. His son, Kyle MacLachlan, goes to visit him in the hospital where he has a huge neck brace and possibly like a tracheotomy or something. It seems he can't talk. Wandering back through a field next to an old abandoned shack, Jeff, who is Kyle MacLachlan, finds an ear lying in the grass. Yuck. He brings the ear to Detective Williams, who then brings it to the coroner for the tiniest autopsy in history, which kind of cracked me up a little bit. The ear was apparently cut off with scissors. Double yuck. And they set up a search grid for the rest of the body. That night, he goes to see Detective Williams at home because he's just curious about the case and, you know, thinks this detective is just going to, like, give him information about it, you know? Detective reassuringly says he can't really talk about it. You know, it's an ongoing investigation and all. Outside the detective's house, Laura Dern emerges from the bushes asking if he's the one who found the ear. They knew each other in high school. She's a senior and he's in college. I think he's home from college right now. Hmm. She's
came to visit dad when he was fell ill.
Ah, gotcha, yeah. Gotcha. She's heard a few things about the ear.
Waka waka.
I enjoyed that. Okay, so she's also overheard some things about a woman singer. This is when I figured out that Sandy is her name. And Sandy takes him to see the apartment building where Dorothy lives. Dorothy is Isabella Rossellini. On the way home, he talks about a guy he knows with the biggest tongue in the world. So now I know what you were talking about in our last episode.
That actually happened, yeah.
Oh, jeez. And shows her a chicken walk, and it seems kind of like they're hitting it off. Later, Jeff picks her up at school and takes her to Arlene's Diner. He wants to break into the woman's apartment, you know, like you do, and he's using all his charms to get Sandy to help him. He's going to wear an exterminator uniform, and she's going to knock on the door pretending to be a Jehovah's Witness. Sandy is very reluctant, but Jeff talks her into it. He knocks on the door of her apartment and then just starts spraying chemicals all over the kitchen, and I start wondering if he's actually qualified to do this or if he's accidentally going to poison everyone.
I get the feeling it's just nothing.
I was hoping it's just like water in a can or something.
He says it doesn't have any smell, so I'm pretty sure it's just nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just crossing my fingers. You know. Kyle MacLachlan would never do that to anyone.
Never,
you know?
Never.
While he's spraying, Dennis Hopper definitely would. Uh-huh. I think Dennis Hopper probably did, actually. Anyways, that's hearsay. While he's spraying, a man in a yellow jacket knocks on the door. Jeff somehow gets out of there, but it turns out he stole keys while he was in there. You know, again, like you do. He's going to try to sneak into the apartment tonight, but Sandy has a date with Mike, whom she loves for the record, but she's going to break it for this caper. Later that night, they go to see Dorothy sing. She's called the Blue Lady. This is when I learned her name is Miss Dorothy Valance, and she sings Blue Velvet. And I love Isabella Rossellini. I wonder. Anyways, she sounds great. they get to her apartment. She's going to wait outside and honk. Oh, Sandy is going to wait outside and honk four times when Dorothy gets there so that Kyle doesn't get trapped. Sorry, Jeff, not Kyle MacLachlan. He's always like just Troy from Sex and the City to me. He's going to sneak in and she's going to drive his car home. So Jeff lets himself in, wanders around his apartment, then takes a moment to pee. And with all the flushing, doesn't hear the horn. Seems like rule number one, don't leave your DNA behind. And two, I mean, I guess he is flushing, so that's taking care of it. But, you know, still. Dumbest way to get caught in an apartment.
Heineken, man.
Yeah. That's Shades true.
John
That's
Travolta
true.
In Pulp Fiction.
That's also true. Yeah. Dorothy gets a phone call from someone named Frank. There's something wrong with John or Don, her son. He's being held hostage or something. We're going to find out a little bit about that later. He makes a sound and she finds him there. She finds Jeff in the closet there. She threatens him with a knife and demands to know what he's doing there. Seems like a reasonable question. She asks if he saw her undress, which he did, then makes him get undressed too. And, you know, fair is fair. So go for it, Isabella. She asks him what he wants, then takes his underwear off and kisses him, you know, down in the bathing suit zone. She says...
The no-no square.
The no-no square, yeah. Although it seems like she is a little to the side. Like, I'm not sure if...
Green kissing it, if you will, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But she also says she'll kill him if he touches her. Then someone knocks on the door and she makes him hide in the closet again. And this is a man named Frank, who is Dennis Hopper. And he is very mean to her. He tells her, to spread her legs and don't look at him. Then he starts inhaling some kind of gas and starts talking in a weird voice to her vagina. And it's a lot. You know, this is kind of what I know Dennis Hopper from, even though I haven't seen this movie. And it's just kind of tainted all of my interactions with Dennis Hopper ever since Speed.
Oh, you know? Just we'll talk about Dennis Hopper later on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We get some stuff where he can.
Oh, yeah. So then he threatens her with scissors, maybe the ear scissors, before assaulting her and hitting her when she looks at him. Then he leaves. I'm not going to give a whole bunch of the details of that assault because I got some thoughts on it later.
It's not nice. It's not
It's a
pretty.
Lot. Yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah. Jeff comes out of the closet and is like, what the fuck just happened? And are you okay? She says she's scared and asks him to hold her. She asks him to touch her breast, then asks her to hit her. He doesn't want to, so he gets dressed and is about to leave. But before he goes to look, he looks at the picture of the man and a little boy in a marriage certificate she hid under the couch. So just snooping away at every possible moment, you know. He's dedicated to the caper. Later that night, he has a dream about Dorothy and Frank. He calls Sandy and they make a date to talk about it. So I think Dorothy is married to a man named Don. And it looks like the son and the husband have been kidnapped by Frank in order to force Dorothy to do things for him, which is Jeff's nice guy way of describing all of that.
Maybe he likes to fuck.
Yeah. Yep. And Jeff thinks Frank cut the ear off of Don as a warning to Dorothy, and he thinks Dorothy wants to die. Jeff is upset by all of this and the fact of people like Frank in the world and how much trouble there is, which just seems pretty understandable to me. And then Sandy tells him a nice story about a dream she had where robins represent love. And it looks like they might be about to kiss, but she says it's time they go, you know, 'cause she's got a boyfriend and all, and they drive away. That night, Jeff goes back to her apartment, and I think this is when he and Isabella Rossellini hook up.
Yes.
I can't remember exactly.
Yeah.
I think it's a couple of times.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's right. More than one. Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. That's true. This is the nicer time, I think. Later,
swimming
he walks
inside her, Jen.
That's what she said.
Yeah.
You know what I thought she said? He put his dick inside me.
Oh, no.
Oh, he did.
I know, but, you know, swimming inside you is a nicer way of saying that. So yeah. I apologize to everyone.
Still kind of a weird thing to say. But still, yeah.
Yeah. She's going through a lot. Artistry. She is. Yes. Yeah. Is that exactly. I mean, mm-hmm. She's got a lot on her mind. Most of which does not involve Jeff.
Let's be honest. Someone said that to you after your first time together, that might be their only, like, yeah, that was, we're going to ghost that person at
Peace.
That point.
Mm. Bye. Nice meeting Peace. You.
Right. Because, little Jeff's just swimming away. Anyways, so later, Jeff watches her at the club. Frank is also in the audience holding a piece of her blue velvet robe as she sings. Jeff watches Frank and some goons leave the club and follows them. The next day, Jeff pulls up to talk to Sandy, but it looks like her boyfriend, Mike, who we never actually see his face, I kind of love, saw them. She says she'll try to talk to him later and then just gets in the car with this guy. So, you know, poor Frank.
We see him a couple times.
I know, but we never, like, I kept waiting for it to be a recognizable actor, and I don't think we ever just get a clear
just
view of his face.
Some nobody, just, you know.
Right. That's what I mean.
Or,
like,
or jilted high school.
He's just kind of a stock Mike character. Not like a real Mike. On our podcast.
Listeners, you can't see Mike's eyes right now, but yeah.
All right. So he tells her he staked out Frank's place. There's another man, the yellow man, who knocked on the door. He saw this man go into Frank's building with Frank. The yellow man, this is where I get a little confused. The yellow man came out to meet a well-dressed man with an alligator briefcase, which is just my favorite sentence. They go to look at a murder. A woman has her leg badly broken and a man is dead. There's a whole lot of drugs there, too. He says he's going back because he's in the middle of a mystery and he likes mysteries. Then he kisses Sandy too, and she says she's worried about him because she got him into it. So she's feeling responsible for this whole thing. Jeff goes back to Dorothy's apartment and they have sex. She asks him if he's a bad boy. Does he want to do bad things? She asks him to hurt her and he reluctantly does. Again, have some thoughts about this. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, Jeff is playing with one of her son's toys. She takes it from him. She asks him to stay and says she's not crazy. She knows the difference between right and wrong, but she wants him to stay. He's her special friend. He says he'll call her. But as he's walking out, Frank shows up. Uh-oh. Then they all go on a joyride and go to Pussy Heaven. Gross. Which doesn't sound nearly as fun as I think the title implies. Dean Stockwell is there and I love him, but he's very high and very fancy. And there are just some ladies sitting around on a couch. They're not impressed that Jeff likes Heineken. PBR is clearly the only choice. Side note, I had an old boyfriend who told me PBR made me smell bad. So I stopped drinking that. Then it turned out it's the boyfriend that sucked and not PBR, you know. Anyways, So that's my backstory with PBR. A lady brings them a tray of beer and they all stand around and drink it. They drink to fucking. Here's to your fuck. They all love beer. They cheers to beer. They punch Jeff and tell him to be polite. It's all very weird. Then Dorothy goes to see her son, who's being kept there in another room. Dean Stockwell lip syncs to a song called A Candy Colored Clown Called the Sandman, which is very 50s dreamy doo-wop-y.
In Dreams.
In Dreams, is that what it's called?
Yeah, Roy Orbison. Roy
Orbison's In Dreams.
Okay.
In English this time, as opposed to Spanish as the last time.
Oh, shit. Okay. Interesting. Okay. Dorothy comes out of the room very sadly, and it's time to hit the road for more joyride. They pull over, and Frank starts inhaling that shit again. He tells Jeff not to look at him. He's got a thing about people looking at him. Mm-hmm. Then he starts obsessing over Dorothy's breasts. Jeff tells him to leave him alone, and he hurts Dorothy. Then Jeff punches Frank. They pull him out of the car. Then Frank kisses him a bunch to get, which I kind of thought was to get a lot of lipstick on his face, or just because Kyle MacLachlan's pretty dreamy. They say he's lucky to be alive, and they play that In Dreams song again. One of the ladies starts to dance on top of the car. Frank says he's going to get a love letter from him, which will fuck him forever and send him straight to hell, you know, like all of my love letters do. Then he wipes the lipstick off his face with the blue velvet. Then Frank beats Jeff while the goons hold him. He wakes up the next morning and walks home. Jeff goes to the police station and is about to tell Detective Williams what he's found out, but then he sees the yellow man. He's a detective also. Ah! Jeff gets the fuck out and brings the invitation or the information to Detective Daddy's home. Friday night, Jeff picks Lieutenant, Andy.
Detective Daddy.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's right. Lieutenant Daddy is John Saxon.
Yeah.
So Jeff picks Andy up for a date, but Detective Yellow is there too. In the car, Sandy asks what the fuck is going on, and I don't think she ever really gets a satisfying answer, but they show up to a party with her high school friends. They dance at the party. They say they love each other, so I guess she's broken up with Mike. Then they leave the party, but I know, yeah, but not so fast. It's Mike. But before he can goon him up, it turns out Dorothy is on his front porch naked and has been beaten. Everyone is like, what the fuck? Mike backs off and is apologizing. Is like, this is a little
Mike
over
is
my
like,
head.
This shit is heavy.
I know. He's like,
I'm going back to play football. Mike remembers he plays football and there are probably other ladies at high school.
Exactly.
And they don't have naked Isabella Rossellinis showing up on their doorstep.
Like, I don't know if I need this.
No, that's a bit too much.
So they go in and Dorothy is kind of clinging to Kyle, saying he's her secret lover. She's saying, I love you. She doesn't want them to call the cops. Sandy realizes something is going on. She does forgive Jeff later, but she's clearly upset. So then Jeff sends everyone to Dorothy's apartment.
This scene cracks me up because Jeff's face is like not cool, man. Like, like it's less about the distress that Dorothy is in, and like, lady, you're blowing up my spot.
I know. You know? She's like, she's right there because she's so not subtle. I mean, you know, there's not a whole lot subtle about this scene, but you know, secret lover, like,
oh yeah,
yeah. So Jeff gets to Dorothy's apartment and finds a man tied up there missing an ear, which I assume is Dorothy's dead husband. Mr. Yellow is standing there with blood all over him, and it looks like there's a hole in his head where you can see his brain, which is okay.
Yeah.
And his radio is in his pocket, trying to get in touch with him. There's a shootout outside the apartment. Jeff decides, he's like, fuck it, I'm going to let the police deal with this. And then he's about to walk out, but the well-dressed man with the alligator briefcase shows up with a gun in his hand. Turns out it's Frank disguised as this well-dressed man. And I like how he's like, well-dressed. Anyways, it's funny how it plays out. So he goes around and looks it for Jeff in the apartment. Jeff is hiding in the living room closet where all of this wackiness began. Frank is approaching him. He shoots Frank in the forehead just as Detective Daddy and Sandy burst in. The cops take care of everything. Jeff and Sandy kiss romantically in the hallway amidst all the bustle. And then we get a zoom out of the ear. He's laying outside looking at a robin. Sandy has made him lunch. Everybody's feeling better. The robin has eaten those beetles, even though eating bugs is gross. Everything is right with the world again. We see the flowers, the picket fences, the fire trucks pass by. And Dorothy's playing with her son, who's wearing that spinning hat. She hugs him, and we close on the final chords of Blue Velvet. Woo! So that's Blue Velvet. Yeah. And it is pretty straightforward. But I'm still like, I feel like there's some symbolism that I might be missing. Yeah. But before we get into all that, let's do a feelings check. And this is where we share our first time watching Blue Velvet and how we feel when we watch it. And Andrew, would you mind kicking us off?
Sure. So this would, I want to say it was around somewhere in 2000, 2001, I saw this for the first time. I think I mentioned this on the Mulholland Drive one. I had a, my vice principal, who was also my driver's ed teacher, loaned me his copy of Eraserhead, and that kind of like got me into it. And Blue Velvet was one of the easier things to get a hold of. And so I watched it after that. And I'm around the same time I got into Twin Peaks. I'm not sure which happened first, but it would have been pretty close to each other. I'm fairly certain I did this first because I remember thinking, oh, this guy, like, it's easy to pretend that Jeff grows up to become Agent Cooper in Twin Peaks. So, so the first time I watched it was around that time. And I remember thinking, this is like extremely, like, this is not a nice movie even back then. And I think it was somewhere around the time when this is the weirdest thing. You would not do this now. But he takes the ear to Detective Williams, and they have, like, no one would do that now.
Totally. That's totally against CSI rules.
Yeah, it's totally against CSI rules. But, you know, it's the mid 80s. They didn't know any better. Williams says one of my favorite pieces of dialogue in, like, all of cinema, and that is, that's a human ear, all right. And that was like, and I was just like in it from there on out. I was like, this film is extremely extreme, but it still has this weird sense of humor there that becomes kind of a thing with just David Lynch in general. That's maybe not the greatest example, but that one...
If it was a beat cop, they would not have known it was an ear. They're like, what is this strange body part? But
yeah,
if he's a detective, it's right on it.
Oh, yeah, he knows. I heard
beat poet, and I just started snapping. It's like, anything can be a human ear. Sorry.
And so it became.
Sorry, Andrew.
I know. Two of us tonight
are incorrigible.
It's all right. So it became the movie that, like, I would watch like a fair amount. It became my at the beginning of the pandemic. Tim, my Dead Letter co-host, and I did a thing on movies we watched when we were sick. And this was one of the movies that I would watch when I was staying home sick. Not exactly sure what that says about me. Maybe it's like, at least I'm not going through that. It's hard to it is kind of a comfort movie, which is like hard to describe why, because there's a lot of not particularly great things going on in this, but I feel like you've had more extreme and bizarre things for that, so I don't have to defend myself too much there. Didn't someone want to do Cannibal Holocaust but then change their mind?
I mean, you know, people find comfort in interesting things, you know?
Yeah. So. And it's, you know, it's still kind of like, it has that sort of, there are kids' movies that follow things like this. So it's, this is someone described this as like the Hardy Boys Go to Hell. And it kind of has that feeling.
Yep.
And I think that's what gets me caught up in it. And I just like the world. It's I also grew up in a small town, not like Lumberton, but you know, I'm seeing something that's always hidden, like that line that he says, like that's something that really resonated with me, because when you're in a small town, you know something evil is happening somewhere.
Mike, what about you?
So I was today days old when I first watched this movie. I literally just finished watching it. We're recording late tonight because I wasn't going to be able to finish the movie in time to start recording on time. And it ruled. Like, this movie was fucking fantastic. I think it'll be another, like, Order of the Criterion.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a good addition,
Which is funny because, like, I just remember years ago my wife casually mentioning this is one of her favorite movies. So I got it for her on DVD. And, like, we are very different movie watchers in that, like, something will be her favorite movie, but she'll never have to watch it again. So it just promptly went in a drawer, like, oh, cool, and then never watched it. Whereas I'll rewatch things over and over again if I really love it. I was familiar with the most popular imagery of this movie. So, like, Frank in particular huffing nitrous oxide and Isabella Rossellini, all that I was, like, very familiar with. It's really straightforward for a David Lynch film. Like, almost mainstream for a David Lynch movie. Like, it's definitely not nearly as trippy as Mulholland Drive. Like, this is now the third thing along with the first two seasons of Twin Peaks that I've watched. I would say, like, the hardest thing about this movie was, given Dennis Hopper's violent history of spousal abuse, anyone who wants details, like, read Peter Biskin's Easy Rider, Raging Bulls. It does not shy away. I mean, his first wife, he beat her pretty bloody, kicked in her car windshield one night so she had to drive home. Like, she eventually escaped with the kids. He had an 8-day marriage to Michelle Phillips of the Mamas and Papas. And I think she famously quoted, like, the first 7 days are great. Day 8, though, not so much. And she left him over Hopper's, like, unnatural sexual demands. Like, yeah, Hopper made Easy Rider. And I don't want to say and then went batshit crazy, because he was batshit crazy when he made Easy Rider. He is... I don't even want to say one, because it's all self-inflicted. Like, really, one of the tragic would be selling it like it would be giving him too much of an out, because his wounds are self-inflicted. But he was really one of the great fucking scumbags of Hollywood. And he would later go on to be one of the more outspoken conservatives of Hollywood as well, like, later in life, which is, you know, when people, like, get on me, like, oh, why don't you like hippies? It's like, this is the reason why. Like, most of the hippies went on to become, like, staunch conservatives. So fuck him. So it was really hard to watch that scene where he is beating the crap out of Dorothy, and then rape might be too strong of a word, but it's, like, a borderline consensual. And really, because, like, there's parts where it looks like Dorothy is actually enjoying it. There's a couple looks that she gives, but I think that it's fair to say it's a non-consensual, it's a sexual assault. So that was really hard to watch.
And despite, it never gets easier.
No.
I've seen this movie a lot, and that scene is still rough.
Yeah. And it's a magnetic performance all around, like all the other scenes given, but, like, it's really hard watching Hopper in that. And it wasn't like it was a secret, so it's casting him in that role seems like a very deliberate choice, because I don't think that this was not like a hush-hush secret. Like, he had a very public meltdown. Watching this movie, I watched most of it on Pluto TV, so every 10 minutes it would go from, like, basically, like, pretty intense, like, sexual sadism to an insurance commercial starring Animal from the Muppets. And then I think David Lynch would approve of watching it like that. But I also then found it on Canopy and was able to, like, power through the rest. But I really, there's a lot to chew on here. And I think in particular, and we get into the movie, like, Lynch's own kind of nostalgia for an America we've been selling since the early 1980s that maybe never really existed. And I hope we can dive into that a bit. But really dug this movie. I could see watching this over and over again. And I'm really glad that Andrew brought this to the table.
This was not my first watch, but it was my first watch all the way through, my first watch to completion, I guess. But I had seen the scene where he's huffing, the first scene where Kyle MacLachlan is in the closet. That's on one of Bravo's 101 scariest movie moments. So another one that fabulous list that I love spoiled for me, which kind of, you know, I'm kind of glad I knew it was coming, you know.
Is that the scariest moment, though?
No, I don't think so. Okay. But I think what they were saying, and I mean, some of it is, I think when they say scariest, it's more like iconically scariest. Yeah, shocking. Because it is, like, it's shocking. It comes out of the blue.
Which,
like,
moment
when
when
he starts huffing, like, the first assault when Frank comes in.
Oh, I would say
in.
It is.
Yeah,
in this
it's,
movie?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, it wasn't number one. It was probably in the 50s somewhere around
there. I would
there,
say for this movie, it's the scariest moment.
Yeah,
I think the second time he huffs the gas, like when they're in the car after, like, and he's about to get beat up, like I think that's where the dread
when
really
he's
gets,
like, smearing the lipstick on.
Yeah, like
maybe just I think, like, only because, like, you have no idea what, like, the first time you see that, you're like, what the fuck am I watching? Like, it's so out there.
Well, and that's, so I knew that was coming, and so I think that made it a little easier. I don't think I was quite ready for. I've got a lot of thoughts on the assault scenes. because I think it is an interesting depiction of that. But again, that's thoughts for our movie discussion. I enjoyed a lot of this. I think I found some of it really hard to watch. I don't know how much I will return to it. But what I did really love, I love Kyle MacLachlan. Again, he's always going to be Troy McDougal from Sex and the City to me, which, and I love him. But then I also really liked Laura Dern. I haven't seen her in a lot outside of Big Little Lies and Jurassic Park. So I enjoyed watching her. The thing I think I'm loving, or I'm really liking about Lynch, is there's this stagey quality to it, like staged movements, which is, I find really soothing, you know? So I could definitely see this being a comfort horror movie. And like, there are some movies that I love where there are just parts I look away from for a minute because it's got like the blood that bothers me. So I could see putting this on to get kind of that feel and that vibe and just kind of maybe leaving the room for a minute during some of the other scenes. Because I did really enjoy it. I think there are a lot of really interesting themes here. And I don't think I think it's a lot more like feeling themes. Like, I think what I am getting from this movie, I don't know if it's what was intended, but like, I see this kind of like the dichotomy between like high school love and adult relationships. I don't know if I want to call that love, but yeah, or just like kind of when you're in college, you're kind of caught in a crossroads of your life. And I see Kyle MacLachlan kind of in the middle of that. And then I think there's this like corruption of the like idyllic town, which I think is really interesting. And I think this movie is a really interesting depiction of an abusive relationship, which is something I want to talk about. But yeah, so those are my thoughts on it. I'm glad I've seen it now because I feel like it is a movie that it's a movie I think I'll probably like to talk about more than I will like to watch, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because like,
there's a lot in here that is my jam, but it's also just, you know, it's hard to watch in some places, you know, well, so let's move into our movie discussion. And I was going to yell, I don't think I'm going to do any more Dennis Hopper impressions now that we know that fun little thing. I know.
Sorry, Jen.
No, that's okay. Hey, I mean, I'd rather know than not know, you know? So, you know who I forgot to talk about, which maybe we can start off and ease us in? I love Dean Stockwell. Like, I was a huge Quantum Leap fan growing up. And so he's Al on Quantum Leap, and he's like Sam's little right-hand man. And so whenever I see him, it just makes me so happy because it just reminds me of this time just when I was a kid. And like, I convinced my parents to let me stay up an hour later so I could watch Quantum Leap every week. And I had a huge crush on Scott Bakula. And this is an interesting part for him. Like, I'm not quite sure what he's doing in this movie or what that whole thing is about, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed him. He's wearing like eyeliner, which I thought was interesting, you know, in the 80s for, you know, so I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
I think I made a note. What does Dean Stockwell's character do when they're not throwing parties? Like, I just had this whole mock scenario in my head of him like getting up and like getting dressed in like, you know, khakis and a button up shirt. And like, you know, maybe he works as like an insurance salesman.
He's helping,
you
know, Sam get back
just
to the
like,
future.
Right. What does this guy do, you know, when it's not like, you know, hey, let's drink to fucking. And he's not lip syncing to Roy Orbison. Like, what does he do in the regular 9-to-5 world? Like, that to me is fascinating.
I kind of wonder if he's Frank's boss to an extent. Because there are, like, so, all right, yeah, it's mainstream, but you still have to put, like, a lot of thought into things to really see connections. And there are times, and like, not every time I watch the movie, but there are times where I think Frank is a little afraid of him.
Or an awe.
Just like a little bit, and like, and that makes me wonder if he's like his boss, like, or if he's like the guy who gets the drugs or something, like,
some kind of power over him.
Yeah, he has some kind of power over him, and that's what I think. I don't know what he does, and for the most part, like, he may just be spending all of his time high at that place.
Yeah,
and like, I don't know, but like, that's sort of how I always kind of thought of it, is that he's Ben. Yeah, Ben is just another important person in the hierarchy of the crime in Lumberton. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was interesting, though, and this whole, because he is like in charge of the house that is keeping the son hostage too, mm-hmm. you know, because, and I think it's kind of easy to forget that when you just kind of get lost in all of the bonkersness that's going mm-hmm. on, like them all just standing around drinking beer, like they're a couple of sips of beer and just screaming about beer, which, you know, reminded me of another unpleasant man. But it's part of this world that I feel like we brush up against in this movie, because there's like the yellow detective dude, there's the well-dressed man in the alligator briefcase that we don't ever really figure out what's going on with that. And I think like, I kind of don't really necessarily need to know that much about mm-hmm. it, because I think the story is from Jeff's perspective and he mm-hmm. is just kind of seeing this other world and being like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm ready for this, you know?
And Jeff would probably spend the rest of his life trying to, like, put it all together.
Oh. He would. He'd probably be stealing everybody's apartment keys.
Yeah. And would probably never really get to a satisfying place.
Yeah.
It's a lot, and I didn't say this in my opening thoughts, but it's a lot. There's a lot of parallels between this and Martin Scorsese's After Hours, a 1985 movie starring Andrew McCarthy, which is much more of a black comedy, mm-hmm. In that you have like these two kind of cornbread like protagonists, like really, if you know, just very plain dudes who get into a situation over their head, and then over the course of like a in After Hours, it's one night here. Feels like this takes place over like one or two days, essentially. Mm-hmm. They're like drawn into events that are increasingly surreal and violent, and they don't have the ability to kind of, you know, extract themselves from it. Mm-hmm. And it's played to like phenomenal comic effect in After Hours, which yeah. I highly recommend everybody check out. And here it's really a lot good. More horrific. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the only Scorsese movie with Cheech and Chong in it. So
yes,
yeah.
Also, my favorite DC hardcore band Bad Brains is in it. So
that's right.
Yeah,
yeah. It's just like, and I've recently read the new Stephen King short story Finn, which kind of has this element to mm-hmm. it where it's like a regular guy just kind of gets caught up in this mix of corruption and just kind of is like. I don't know, mm-hmm. you know, yep. which I think is maybe one of the underlying themes I see here is that Jeff maybe is kind of choosing what it's like, I think he's tempted by this mystery and this larger world of corruption, but he's ultimately decides, no, I'd rather stay in my safe little cocoon of, you know, being in this innocence for a little longer, you know, which I mean, I can't blame him, you know, and. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes a while to get ready for that. I feel like I see this really, like, Dorothy's story is like the real harsh world where mm-hmm. you're just kind of out there and you're on your own. And then Sandy's world is this very protected, you know, her father is a law enforcement, you know, and she has a lot of people that are trying to protect her and care about her. And I think, you know, so I think Jeff, ultimately the story to me seems like Jeff is choosing that world for now. You know,
mm-hmm. Anna, he could have just left it alone.
He could have just left it alone. Yep. But I mean, I also like I can understand the temptation, you know, mm-hmm. like when he's like, I'm in the middle of a mystery. I like mysteries. And it's sometimes you get in the middle of this kind of stuff and you don't realize how upsetting and how corrupt and how traumatic it's going to be until you're already in the midst of it. And you can't really get out. And you got to shoot somebody to get out. You know,
I really love that last scene. Where when he's in Dorothy's apartment and he hears the gunshots outside mm-hmm. and he's walked in on like her murdered husband, and who looks like he was very obviously tortured before he was murdered, and the man in the yellow suit who has part of his brain leaking out of his skull but he's still alive, like that's mm-hmm. one of the really horrific things.
Yeah.
I'm like, is his corpse nailed to the floor? It's like, oh no, he's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And after a few minutes he's like, I'm just gonna let the police handle this one. And he's mm-hmm. already so far in over his head at that point, which just again the thought of him, like they're outside shooting, like what does he think he's gonna happen if he saunters out through the front at that point?
Mm-hmm.
But I found like that really like, okay, now this has gone too far now.
Yeah, you know. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, what did he think was going to happen when he broke into a lady's apartment, too? You know, that's mm-hmm. where I feel like you know, he kind of invited a lot of this on himself, you know. So
the weird thing is so there, so this, of course, everything has deleted material and everything. So I watched some of it today, and there would have been like a good 40 minutes before he went back to Lumberton almost, because he like, he's at so we find out that Jeffrey has like kind of a history of voyeurism to an extent. Because we see him like he's at a party and he's watching he's watching this almost attempted rape happen, and he stops it or tries to stop it at least. And then one of his friends gets him and says, oh, by the way, something happened with your dad or something. And so we kind of like, and it's interesting that he stops that one, but not the later one. But they cut it out for a good reason. But that gives us like a good, that kind of makes you wonder more about Jeff. Like, does he already had an interest in this? And he followed through on it, and I guess learned a lesson, I guess.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to see like the comparison between movie Mike, not our podcast Mike, and Frank, is that like they're both kind of in the same realm of like, I don't know, aggressors versus against someone they feel like is taking their girl in quotation marks, but it is a wildly different world, you know, on both sides of that. And I love the scene where Mike is like, no, I'm sorry. This is over my head. Like, I feel like that shows really clearly the difference between Frank and Mike. Although Frank is a whole, but whole thing.
Even then, like, they both have their entourage, right? I mean, you have... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they both Frank, got their bag of goons, right. You know?
Frank has a young Brad Dourif and a couple others.
Yeah.
And Mike has... And the last thing, you know, one of Mike's crew says, like, I thought you were going to kick his ass. Like, even after seeing what just went down, like, there's still that one pseudo-tough guy that is like, hey, man, we came here to see some violence.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of a nice way to depict like that division between like, or like that top surface layer of like Norman Rockwell's America. There's not very much that separates that from, you know, when you look at like, say, Bedford Falls from Pottersville, there's not that many steps in between the two of them. That would be It's a Wonderful Life.
Okay.
Which I think you haven't seen. So
I have not.
I fucking love that movie so much. I think I'll watch that tomorrow.
It's a good palate cleanser compared to this. Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned the voyeurism, because I kind of made a note here about like, this would be a great movie when we get to kind of covering like kink and paraphilia.
I was thinking about that.
Because what you see here, like, I didn't know, you know, with Jeff, like, if that voyeurism like extended past that first. So he's in the closet out of necessity because he's been caught. But it's interesting that, you know, you mentioned that, yeah, that would have extended in some of the deleted scenes. But what you see here are like pretty graphic depictions of sexual sadism and sexual masochism. And not that those two things on their own make a paraphilic disorder. What separate, because you can have consensual adults that do engage in those activities out of pleasure and gratification. No kink shaming here, but where it becomes a disorder is when the person's arousal centers on another person's like psychological distress. And it's very, very clear that Frank is getting off not just in dominance, but getting off in hurting Dorothy in a way that causes her a lot of like impairment and distress, both physically and psychologically. And I think I put, you know, like, borderline, am I being too generous here? Like, is this non-consensual? And I think the more I kind of like turn it over in my head, like, it's very clearly a non-consensual relationship between the two of them.
Coerced is what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like that, like, it is under this giant umbrella of coercion, because he is holding her son hostage, which I think tends to, like, I feel like can be read as a little muddy when you look at each individual incident, you know, which is where I think a lot of men or a lot of aggressors can tell themselves that a woman is consenting when they don't understand the larger power dynamic at play, you know.
I almost didn't know with that relationship, like, was it some sort of like agreed upon power dynamic that went too far in a relationship? Like, was everybody in on it And even then, like, because the child can't consent to being kidnapped, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, was it something between, like, Don, Frank, and Dorothy that was maybe agreed upon? And then it just went too far. There are I don't want to say hints of that, but it was like, because it's Lynch, and like, is a kidnapping ever just a kidnapping, if that makes sense? You know, because obviously relationships can look non-traditional and still be very healthy. This was not a case of that, to say the least.
Yeah. I guess my headcanon for it, and this is, I don't know how to like back this up with anything in the film other than the fact that we see Dennis Hopper watch her sing and like really good, like the backstory that I invented was like he just saw her singing one time, got really obsessed with her, and figured and maybe tried legitimate means of trying to get with her that didn't go anywhere, and so he went to this other route instead.
That's kind of what I am getting too, and I've been recently listening to this series on You Must Remember This is doing a series on 80s erotics or erotic thrillers, and they were talking about Deep Throat and how Deep Throat is like apparently the actress was coerced into a lot
Linda
of that.
Lovelace?
Yeah, Linda.
She's been very open about saying how like you're watching a woman being raped every moment I'm on screen.
Right. And so that, I think, was in my head when I was watching this. And I was like, I don't know how much her husband, I just kind of had her husband as her manager in mind. And maybe Frank was trying to kind of along the lines of what you were saying. And I think in the 80s, that wouldn't seem as cut. And like that would have been a little more of a gray area than it is now. Like now I think it clearly is read as a power dynamic, but
yeah, it would be the kind of masculinity that would be celebrated in the 80s. Like there are certain men that don't say no, that don't take no for an answer, and they'll keep charging on. And there can be some areas in life where that can be a good thing outside of like the power dynamics of a romantic entanglement or a sexual entanglement. But I think that translated or that was transferred to all areas of life, and that kind of man who was like, you know, don't take no for an answer was celebrated back then, where now we look at that and obviously we see consent, I think, and hopefully see it with much more understanding.
Yeah Well, since we're talking about it, I wanted to talk about the whole assault thing, and I talked about this on an episode of Certified Forgotten when I talked about the movie Eat Me, which I don't know if y'all, I don't, Mike, you haven't seen that yet, right? It's a lot. I talked about this in our last episode, but it's a really, really triggering movie, but it's good in a lot of ways. But one of the things that I found really interesting about this is I don't think we ever see Frank and Dorothy have sex. Like, I think the acts that they are actually doing, like, it looks like they're mostly remaining clothed the whole time. But I feel like this scene gets the feeling of a sexual assault that a lot of movies miss, because they are focused more on like the graphic nature, like the clothes off, or like what is actually happening with the mechanics of sex, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, there would have been a lot more nudity if this was made in the 70s.
Exactly. Yeah. But I feel like this gets, this feels uncomfortable to watch in a way that sexual assault is uncomfortable. Like, it's, you don't know what's going to happen. Like, it, you feel exploited. Like, you don't know, you just don't know what's going to happen next. And I feel like this really gets the feeling of that in a way that doesn't feel like could be read as salacious or like, somebody could find erotic if they were kind of into that. Like, I don't think there's any way to really find this erotic, you know?
No, because Frank is pathetic in those moments. Like, there are, I mean, you're looking, I mean, from, we're called psychoanalysis, like, you're getting into some real Freudian shit here, where, you know, he's yelling, like, baby wants to fuck, as he's pressing his face up against, you know, Dorothy's, like, pubic mound, like, literally trying to crawl back inside of the womb in that moment. And like, he's just like, when he tells her to spread her legs apart, and then his voice goes up like 3 octaves and he just starts yelling mummy over and over again, like, they it's not just the, what's so powerful about this scene is it's not just like the physical dynamic of like watching her abuse, watching him abuse her and the don't look at me. And I think that, mm-hmm. you know, saying that, and there's 3 points in that movie where that is like, because there's like deep down, there is some shame that is there. There is this shame at who he's become, this kind of like infantilized in a lot of ways. But what he really wants is to, I mean, like very literally wants to fuck his mother. And we don't usually go Freudian here.
Hey, Freud. Yeah.
but I think in this case, like it plays out in a pretty obvious way. And that it's so on the nose and so discomforting that it lends the scene more so than I think if it was just like a graphic, like to your point, a graphic sexual assault.
Yeah.
Because to make someone privy to those issues when they don't want to be is is just unsettling.
Well, and just the way he like makes her display herself, you know, it's just so uncomfortable. And I think it really kind of gets at the heart of what sexual assault is. It's not necessarily for sexual gratification. It's more about power and dominance and humiliation. And I think that's what this scene really shows. And I think it allows you to get in Dorothy's head in a way that other movies don't, because they are more focused on like the more graphic stuff. So yeah. Yep. So well done there, because I feel like that these kinds of scenes are what allows people who have never experienced that kind of thing to really understand why it is so traumatic and why it's hard to deal with and recover from, you know?
Yep.
So, yeah. But it's a lot. Whew.
Yeah.
What do the two of you make? Because I don't know what to make of it, per se, of like Dorothy using like Frank's language when she's with Jeff, like using a lot of that don't look at me and being like very forceful and kind of like vacillating between that tenderness and then also wanting to get, you know, wanting to indulge her own masochism. What were your takes on that?
Well, okay. You go first.
No, go ahead.
Okay, so I guess I've seen the movie a little bit more. So for me, it's this is how she's responding to the situation. Like, she's been going through this like ongoing traumatic event. We don't really know how long this has been going. Like the kidnap part. I mean, like that ear was pretty decayed when he found it, so that was definitely there for more than one day. And so like this has been going on for, I imagine, a number of weeks. And so I think she's having a shift happen. And so like, and you know, when you talk to sexual assault victims, like sex gets really messed up just in general, even when you're with a partner that you're like, that you love and you want to be with. And so I don't know how like correct it is, but that that's the sort of thing that I see happening is that she's like been going through this like awful event. And this is how she's, I'm not going to say cope, but this is how she's getting through it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of the read that I have. And that's kind of, you know, not to get too personal, although I've talked a little bit about this before, but like that's some things that I've kind of experienced is like trying to like taking on the language and the behavior of people who have been abusive to me, because that's what the power feels like, you know? And so that's a way of feeling like you are regaining the power. And also like you just kind of, when you're trying to make your mind fit into this box that you can't really see out of, it just the sex gets real messed up. And it's like you said, it's just hard to, it's easier to tell yourself that that's just like what it is, or that you like something that you don't, because admitting that there is a multiple day like situation where you don't have any power is just really hard, you know? So, and I think it, like after I got out of my first marriage, I found myself being kind of, this was more so in just arguing with some boyfriends more than anything like in the realm of Frank. But like I feel like I was kind of working out what was happening and trying to kind of replay some of it in my mind to try to get a different outcome this time, because I knew I had more power in this situation. So if I could kind of put myself back in that situation again, but then know that I had the power to get out of it this time, I feel like that kind of was helping me process everything, but I still don't, I wasn't really aware of that for a couple of years. But yeah, that's kind of what I make of that whole thing. And I did want to talk about the, she wants him to hurt her, like, 'cause he doesn't want to, and she knows that. And so I think she can kind of experience, she can, maybe part of her mind can pretend that that is Frank and that she is able to have some control in this situation, you know? It's just a lot, you know? Sorry. Ooh.
Comfort.
Comfort horror, right? No, but I mean, seriously, like, it is, it's like, it's good to talk about this kind of stuff, you know? And I appreciate you guys listening and, you know, it's just, it's a lot. And I think this is something that a lot of people go through. And I was not prepared for the movie to really go to that level with her relationship with Jeff. And I'm glad that it did, because that feels real. You know, it feels like something that she would be going with. Like, I don't think she cares about Jeff. I think she is looking at him as a kind man who is going to treat her well. And that's really all she wants. And that's why I love the end of the movie, just is her with her son, not her with him, you know?
Yeah. And her face is like, there's like a moment of joy. And then it kind of goes to the, what if I, like she, there's a moment of like her still processing.
Oh, like, I didn't realize. Well, she is still singing the song, you know, the song is playing, which is the song of this corruption, you know? Yeah. So, ooh.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, that, can we talk about the song for a moment?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I, you know, was doing some reading, you know, while watching the movie or pausing in between. It's just formulating some thoughts. And like, it, there was an article, I think, when this movie first came out in the New York Times, and Lynch talked about the kind of like genesis of this movie. And he said it was the song, like Bobby Vinton's Blue Velvet, because on its surface, like, it's this very sweet tune about like a man falling in love with a woman. And really what it is like, this guy is kind of peering in on her. Like, he's like, what he saw was like a guy peering in a voyeuristic fashion on a woman, and that setting up like a kind of murder, kind of like setting up her murder in some ways. And his brain went there. And I think that that is one of the, and again, I am by no means like a David Lynch expert. This is like the third thing with him, but the, I see a lot of Twin Peaks in Blue Velvet. Like, this feels like kind of like a dress rehearsal.
Oh, nice.
Excellent. You know what? Before I get into my thing then, Andrew, like, take it away. Because you could probably go much deeper, but I'm like, huh, I'm getting huge Blue, and not just because of Laura Dern and Kyle.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, so this is very much like a rough draft for Twin Peaks in a lot of ways. So there was a movie, it's a big salacious movie, not a big salacious movie, but a salacious book before called Peyton Place. And, yeah, and that kind of like riffs on this to an extent. I mean, Hope Lang was in Peyton Place, and she's in this too. And then and then later, Tamblyn, you know,
Tamblyn?
Russ Tamblyn,
With
Tamblyn.
The glasses?
Yeah, with the glasses. Like, he's in Twin Peaks, but he was also in Peyton Place. So, I mean, like, so even though, like, even though Lynch and Mark Frost watched Peyton Place and they were, like, not that impressed with it, but they kind of knew what they wanted to work with. That was after Blue Velvet, though. But there's definitely, like, that kind of idyllic small town full of problems thing going on. So, like, that's where I think a lot of that genesis comes from. And so, like, random things that I noticed that happen again is Kyle throws stones at something.
I've seen that part in Twin Peaks. I got up to the llama, but I saw that.
Yeah, it was like a random, like, oh, that happened. So they watch in Twin Peaks, there's a soap opera that they watch called Invitation to Love. And that kind of like kind of makes fun of what's going on in that universe to an extent. And the aunt and Jeffrey's mom are watching some weird crime thing on TV all the time. And so, like, I think that's kind of like a shades of that. The Slow Club is definitely a rough draft for the Roadhouse in Twin Peaks, especially in Twin Peaks, The Return. Every episode of Twin Peaks, The Return, like, ends with a band, a real band, a real life band, like Nine Inch Nails playing playing there. And then, like, oh yeah, there's a jerk boyfriend named Mike. Like, that was, I had not noticed that until today. I was like, oh, I never never put that together before.
Because Mike's can't catch a break, right?
Mike's,
to be honest, Sorry, Mike. We are a bunch of pricks.
you are. There are a lot of you. So
there are. Yeah, quite a few.
It stands to reason. And then like just some other Lynch things that you know that show up again, like in Fire Walk With Me, which is the only thing that is like 100% a David Lynch movie and 100% a Nicolas Cage movie. There's like a fire motif in that this has as well. And then there's lip syncing to Roy Orbison, except this time actually Roy Orbison instead of in Spanish. But both of those scenes are both. Kind of like, I don't know if the one with Dean Stockwell is what I would call particularly beautiful. The one with Rebecca Del Rio is particularly beautiful, but also terrifying. Whereas the one with Dean Stockwell is kind of whimsical, but also kind of terrifying at the same time.
Yeah. So, it's just unsettling. Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of Twin Peaks stuff. Yeah. And then Twin Peaks people show up later too. I mean, like Jack Nance is like, he's Paul. And like, there's people that, you know, there's casting stuff that he would repeat a lot. Oh, and there's someone named, someone at the hardware store is named, two guys actually are named Ed at the hardware store.
Oh. which, so, yeah. I remember that from, no, Twin Peaks. Yeah. I'm
gonna yeah, yeah.
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Double Ed instead of Big Ed in this case. And okay, I watched this movie for at least a decade before I finally figured out how he's able to figure out the finger thing. So like I had to see it on the big screen to actually see this happen. So blind Ed has seeing Ed behind him, and he pokes him in the back 4 times. Yeah, and I did not catch that for like I saw this movie at least a decade before I finally caught that. So yeah.
Oh my gosh, that reminds me of the time I have a friend that I used to drink with who was a clown. And so he knew a lot of card tricks. He also would juggle swords when he was really drunk, which was terrifying. But he was playing this card trick where he was guessing my card over and over and over again, and it took me forever to realize he was just in front of a mirror. He was holding it up. Oh, that's how he's seeing it. So yeah. Yeah.
Right, what did you catch?
Movie
Mike?
Magic.
I was gonna say that it just felt like in terms of the themes of the movie, the aesthetics of the movie, it just felt like a lot of a dry run. Just things like going back into the nightclub, and it's a recurring motif in a lot of Lynch's work. Apparently, so you have these like surreal nightclubs, like that conversation between Laura Dern and Kyle MacLachlan. When they're like, oh, I like Heineken. Like, it's just this weird kind of like kitschy, doesn't really, you could cut that out.
King of Mirrors, yeah.
But it adds to the surrealism of the Blue Velvet overall. Mm-hmm. But what I picked up on throughout watching Lynch is this kind of longing for this American dream that we've been sold. And it's this kind of America that doesn't really exist. Mm-hmm. Or if it did, it existed only for a select few people. And I know Lynch has come under fire at times for potentially having some conservative views, which seems weird given his work, which is very humanistic.
Yeah.
And I think that he might fall under the trap, not the trap, he might fall under the umbrella of like a very socially progressive and accepting person who at the same time does pine for a time period in America where things were quote unquote simpler. In 2018, he came under fire for saying that like Donald Trump could go down as one of the greatest presidents because of the way that he shook things up. And he walked back those comments pretty quickly when he realized how they were being taken. I think as an artist, he was like, oh, this is someone who is not playing by your typical like Washington bellwether, you know, he's very much doing his own thing. And we saw in the 80s with Reagan, like probably some of the greatest subversive art and artists emerged from the early to late 80s. Like that whole period, there is some fantastic transgressive art that came out of being a reaction to Reaganism and a backlash to like mourning in America and the politics, how politics is at a spouse, where I honestly don't think we've seen that. From 2016 on, I don't think the art we've seen is in any way a reflection or a pushback against where conservatism and the alt-right movement becoming much more mainstream. I don't see the pushback in that in art, film, and music that one would expect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe a lot of that is because you have so many fewer companies now, and it's much harder to get things done.
I think that's part of it.
I made a mental note that like Blue Velvet walked so A24 could run.
Absolutely.
I think is yeah. kind of like what this reminded me of. But what you see here, like in the opening, and I'll try to keep this brief because I don't want to EM her on. You see like a very much like a Norman Rockwell type of mm-hmm. town. Mm-hmm. White picket fences, friendly firemen like on spotless red engines, children running through town, a man watering his rose garden. And within, and it's just slow motion, it's gorgeous. And then it's very quickly, it's undercut.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a heart attack that does the dad
I think
in?
It's a stroke.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
It took me like
stung by a bee at first.
5 years for me to decide this, yeah. but I think it's yeah. a stroke.
That hit me really hard because I had a friend, a really dear friend in 2015 who he was at a punk show and it was like a 95 degree August day and he loved to dance. And he was honestly one of the few people that could get me back to dancing at my advanced age yeah. whenever I would see him at a show. And he was overheated. He went outside, he collapsed, he hit his head and he died.
Wow.
And it's hits still hard. So that hit hard. That was like going to pause this mm-hmm. for a few minutes because that was just to see something so beautiful just undercut. And that's Lynch's thing. He's like, either A, these periods don't, as much as I want them, and you see it in Mulholland Drive with old Hollywood, you see like the Pacific Northwest, the beauty of like blue collar America and Twin Peaks, and here those like Rockwell paintings, or Saturday, it's like the Saturday Evening Post of the 1950s brought to life. And it's very quickly, but like what's lurking under that is like characters like Frank, that swim these waters like the shark in Jaws.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, that's what I thought was interesting about the Beatles and the Robin, you know, and I kind of got like with the whole, the Robin kind of cracked me up at the end because it's so clearly not a real Robin, but I still really enjoyed that Robin a lot. Yeah. More so because I think there's a robin's nest right outside my, in one of my planters that Corey got me for Mother's Day. Nice. But anyways, but yeah, like the Beatles are like the corruption that is underneath. But you know, in a lot of ways, like if the Beatles aren't there, can you have the grass, you know? So there's like this element of privilege too, that Sandy gets to live in this house, yep. but Dorothy is stuck in this like hell that she's can't get out of, you know?
Well, and Sandy lives in that house because her dad deals with the Beatles all day.
That's true. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't think about that. Yeah. And so she has no, that's a good point. But I feel like the Robin is like reestablishing the normalcy by eating the bug, even though I love that grandma who's like, bugs are gross. I would never want to eat a bug. I think
she's a Twin Peaks person too.
I recognized her. Yeah. Because bugs are pretty gross. But yeah, you have to have the bugs, I think, in a lot of ways. And I think that like kind of goes to what you're saying, Mike, is that this idyllic world does exist. It just doesn't exist all the time, and it doesn't mm-hmm. exist for everyone. And a lot of people's reality is the Beatles yeah. too, you know.
I mean, the 80s were a time that there was a lot of reckoning for the 1950s. There was mm-hmm. a lot of nostalgia mm-hmm. for that. You saw Stand By Me was a huge hit, even like a year before this, Back to the Future.
Yep.
Stephen King's It. You know, if you haven't read the book and only know the current movie, like the book takes place in half of it takes place in the late 50s. And there was this like real longing for that mm-hmm. point in mm-hmm. America. And a lot of the populist art really kind of fetishized it. And I think Lynch does that as well with a lot of his work. Like he really has this, and profiles on Lynch talk about like his personality. Like he's very much like, for a guy who makes this incredibly surreal, fucked up art, he is very cheeky.
Mm-hmm.
He's very fucking handsome as fuck, dude. Even now, like, is just a gorgeous man. But his, like, catchphrases are like golly and gee willikers, and he's very mm-hmm. earnest about it. Like it's not done with a wink and a nod. Like he's just that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talked openly about like really enjoying like growing up in the 50s or and kind of a longing for it while also understanding, you know, we're kind of putting a fresh coat of paint on something that maybe wasn't that clean to begin.
Yeah, and that's when I look at Laura Dern's character. I mean, first of all, her name is Sandy, which I feel like is just—it's very Grease, you know. Although I don't know if Grease predated this, but
it did. That's the 70s.
At least the musical I know did. Yeah. But there's like just her styling is very like white picket fence. Like she's wearing these dresses, and I feel like that's kind of when I look at what I have seen of Twin Peaks and of Mulholland Drive, like. There's just different evolutions of that, of this really put together kind of woman who kind of has it like she's eating apple pie for dessert every night, you know. Yep. And then there's like the who's the bad girl in Twin Peaks who wears the red heels. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's that kind of alternative. And I wonder if this movie were longer, because I think Dorothy is a little more mature than Audrey is in Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm. Like, she represents a different thing, but I feel like Audrey is kind of maybe the Jeff that's kind of tempted by this lifestyle or this corruption. And again, I haven't seen enough of Twin Peaks to say that, but it's just interesting to see. And that's partly what I find soothing and digestible, but also like really evocative, because it's just this iconography that evokes this really strong nostalgia that you bring to it. Like your own past, and like my neighborhood, it was imagining as the street. So I don't know. I wanted to ask about the ear, because first of all, there's the ear cut off with scissors, but then we get this close up into the ear canal and then a zoom out into Kyle MacLachlan's ear. And so I was thinking, is it possible to read this as he finds an ear, he brings it to the police station, and he imagines everything else?
Oh.
And that this is like, I wonder what this ear is, you know? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess with David Lynch, anything is really possible, kind of. But I was wondering if the zoom in or the zoom out, like, what do y'all make of that?
I just thought of it as like circular storytelling, but my only qualm with that read would be, I don't know why Laura Dern and her dad would be there at the end, though.
Why you would imagine meeting her? They were already dating, maybe he could.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
Yeah, there's a wistfulness to those finders. Almost like it wraps up too perfectly at the end, so I could definitely, I wouldn't completely discredit that reading of it. And he did know her from high school.
Yeah,
so, that's true.
Well, there's that thing, I don't know, like...
And they're neighbors, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I remember when my dad passed, there was like a friend's younger sister came to give condolences, and I had kind of always thought she may have had a crush on me. Mm-hmm. And I definitely indulged, and you know, when I was very, sad and vulnerable and you know, at home, like, oh, what would it be like if I called her and we started dating, type of thing, because she was a familiar face.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could see that. Like, his dad is in the hospital. Who knows? He's obviously pretty fucked up.
Yeah.
So you could see, like, finding this, dropping it off, and then, like, daydreaming that you're... Because he's ultimately the hero of the story. Like, he single-handedly rescues Dorothy and takes down Frank by blowing the brains out of the back of his skull.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a very surreal, dreamy scene at the end. Mm-hmm. And Andrew, I don't know if you've seen the extended cut of this movie, but there's a scene where they all walk out and they get into a convertible, and then the top closes and it's got Freddy Krueger stripes on it. And they pull
it. And In Dreams starts playing.
Oh, In Dreams. Ugh.
Hope Lang is the mom and... Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. She is the mom.
She is, actually, you're right. Yeah, she totally is, yeah.
Hell yeah.
Oh!
Does it hurt you?
Mind blown. That came out in 85, so... Frank's first two letters of Freddy are Frank.
Frank. Oh, shit.
Just saying.
Well, do we want to talk about Frank anymore than we do?
What do we think we have to say? I mean, he's like, he's just a force of nature. That
he seems like more. The only thing I think I want to say about him that we haven't already said is he seems more like an idea than a person.
Oh, totally.
To me, you know, I was watching him and I was like, this doesn't feel like a real person,
right?
Unless you read him as just altered all the time, which is totally possible because he's huffing whatever that shit is. But I just,
I think it's nitrous.
Nitrous is my guess.
Nitrous oxide, yeah.
Or, you know, but I just kind of read him as like, he is the adult chaos, you know, that is like kind of at the heart of this corruption. But
yeah, he's evil Homer Simpson. He's like, if Homer is all the positive thing, well, not 100% positive, all the less destructive things of id, Frank Booth is the flip side of that.
Well, and you know, Homer's nemesis is named Frank, I think.
Oh, good point.
Frank Grimes.
Yeah.
Also,
this goes all the way to the top.
Also, all the walls in Blue Velvet are very pink, like the walls in like the Simpsons house and everything. That was something I noticed this time that I hadn't before. I was like, they live in Springfield, apparently.
I was fascinated by these sets too.
Yeah.
Especially like when I think the time I started noticing was when he sat down at the table after he's been beat up by Frank and he's got the two ladies, Barbara and the other lady. Mm-hmm. And the table is just so teeny tiny, you know, and it just feels like a stage table, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I was looking at Dorothy's apartment. I was like, that's an odd place for couches. That's a weird, like, it just looks very so stagey. Open. Right. Which, I mean, kind of goes to that surreal quality, which I really enjoy about it. And it's like, what is real, you know?
Yep. I think it's supposed to be off of Francis Bacon. Like, he's an artist. I think that's where a lot of that came from. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if 100%, or if I'm remembering correctly. Francis Bacon is like another name too. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I was also thinking, like, this is an interesting place for a closet too.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like,
but I've lived in a lot of weird apartment buildings, so I'll accept any kind of bizarre architecture.
That's true. Yeah. But yeah, I also was really enjoying the staircase that is outside, just open air staircase. You know, I was like, that's kind of fun. So, you know, just lots of little visual details that are unique and interesting, but not in like a cliche way. Like in Flatliners, I was just gaga over Nelson's apartment. And this one, it's just like, this interesting. I wonder what the point of this is, or if there is a point, and it's, or it's just kind of trying to get this feeling of this isn't real, you know?
I do have one more thing about Frank, actually.
Okay.
So for a long time, my buddies and I, that we would debate on if Frank is the most evil character in like cinema. I'm not going to say he's not a totally written out character. He's not multidimensional. He's complicated, but he doesn't have a lot of depth.
Yeah.
But and so like we would often get in a fight on whether or not if he met Hannibal Lecter, what would happen? And our thing was, I always went with like, chances are Hannibal would have been shot within the first minute or something before he even got to do any of his like psychological shenanigans. So I don't know. That's where I stand on that. But like he is like, to me, he is like the apex of cinema evil. Maybe Nurse Ratched is up there as well, or like maybe might be getting just behind him. But yeah.
What's that? It's like a 9 thing grid of like chaotic, neutral and chaotic. Yeah. So he would be like the chaotic evil type, you know,
because totally.
I feel like the thing that I think differentiates in my mind him and Hannibal Lecter is organization, you know, and and intelligence. And I feel like you really hit it when you said id, like he just does whatever the fuck he wants in the moment based on this, whatever he's huffing all day, you know, which is terrifying in its own way because you never know what he's going to do because he doesn't know what he was going to do, you know, whereas I feel like if I'm not Hannibal Lecter's target, I'm probably okay, but if I'm around Frank, then who knows what's going to happen, you know? So, yeah.
Totally.
Was there anything else we want to say about Blue Velvet? I feel bad saying this one thing, because I love Isabella Rossellini, but I was really wanting, like, a really big, powerful musical moment, and she's a fairly good singer, and I might cut that out, because I feel really guilty saying that, but... I just was not blown over by her rendition of this song.
Maybe it tells us more about the state of show business in Lumberton.
Could be, yeah. But not I mean, exactly that's her song. She wants to do it, you know, go for it.
Not exactly the hotbed for entertainment, Lumberton.
Yeah, Lumberton.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, with a name like Lumberton, you know.
More like Bumbleton. Sick burn.
Well, okay. Is there any, I feel like there's a lot going on here and we've already talked about a lot of mental health topics. I'm not really sure there's anything else to really dig into other than, like, I think a lot of it would be interesting to see Frank without this nitrous that he's huffing, to see how much of this is addiction and how much, like, what is he actually like when he's not altered all the time, you know? Mm. I don't know if I care that much about yeah. him, but I do think there's an element of addiction in this movie.
Sure.
And you could also look at, you know, I don't know. I don't know if it's fair to say that Jeff is, like, addicted to this drama, but given what you said about some of the deleted scenes, I think
it's just a curious thing. I mean, in the yeah. this film itself, like, no, but if we yeah. had that original draft version, maybe
yeah, I don't know, that yeah, that feels like maybe adjacent to what
yeah
I think I would say about that. But yeah, is there anything else we want to mention before we uplift ourselves?
Let's get uplifted.
All right, and now it's time for an uplifting moment. This is where we share any grounding and coping techniques or any self-care that's been particularly effective for us. Grounding and self-care are the little tips, tricks, mantras, or practices that help us get through the hard days or hard moments. And self-care is anything we do that makes us feel good or feel better. I have been having just the most stress and just a lot of, it's been just kind of a rough couple of weeks. And I've been listening to Dune, which I saw the movie and I had always kind of made fun of it. I was like, oh, it's like the Tremors movie, right? Because of the sandworms. And I just kind of dismissed it as sci-fi that I wouldn't be interested in. And then I really enjoyed the movie. And Corey, I bought the book, but I just don't have that much time to iRead. And so Corey listened to the audio and I started listening to it. And what I love is that it has absolutely no connection to my life at all. And that is very soothing right now. Like, whenever I get on social media, there's something that's either pissing me off or, like, yeah. terrifying me or breaking my heart. And then if I listen to podcasts, like, even talking about just reality right now, it sometimes feels a little bit too stressful for me. So this is, it's a really good version. There are lots of voices, which I thought was going to really annoy me, but I'm really enjoying it, especially all the accents, like just the Muad'Dib. I'm enjoying how this lady says it. And it's just been really soothing because I'm not covering it for work. I don't have to have an opinion on it. It is, has no connection to my life or anybody I know, and I'm really enjoying it. So yeah, check out Dune. This new story, I don't know if you guys have heard of, it's pretty good, you know.
Ties into this episode, so hey.
Yeah.
David Lynch directed.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, and Kyle MacLachlan was, yep. Dude. Oh, man.
Look at
that.
Goes
all the way to the top.
All the way.
That kind of freaked me out a little bit.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Oh.
So it's Memorial Day weekend as you record this, and I had basically two things I needed to get done before this weekend lets out. And number one was cut the grass, which is done.
Woo.
And number two was get a grill. Mm. And listeners, I do not like to spend money on myself. So it's let alone like $300-$400 and a good grill. So I did find a secondhand one on Marketplace and got them down to $80 on a really nice grill, which did not fit in the back of my RAV4. It was too wide. Now, luckily, by luck would have it, they're like 6 or 7 houses down from us. Mm. So listeners, you bet. I rolled that grill like the quarter mile up to my house after paying for it.
Nice.
People were beeping like, what the fuck is this guy doing? But damn it, I have that grill. And did I not make chicken drumsticks with eggplant and green and red orange peppers on it tonight? Oh, you bet.
Yum.
I did. So I'm really happy I got both of those things done this weekend. Those are literally the only two things I wanted to do. That and my form of self-care, because I'm like studying for the licensure exam. So I'm at this desk, taking practice exams, reading, watching like pre-recorded seminars on YouTube. And every now and then I'll stop and I will just watch like a video. Cause I've just finished watching Winning Time on HBO. Mm. And as a Celtics fan, I find that as good as that series is, very offensive. I love the dude they have playing Larry Bird in that. And I do know in later seasons, they damn better well get to the friendship of Magic and Larry. But the dude they have playing Larry Bird is so fucking awesome in it. Like at one point, they just zoom in on his face and it's for a character intro. It just says, you know who I fucking am. I'm like, that's right, you're Larry Legend, basketball Jesus. I love you. I am so fortunate I grew up as a sports fan in the 80s. So I've been watching, long way to say what I've been doing for self-care is watching videos of other ballers of his time talking about how he was the greatest trash talker of all time. Like just telling, you know, and them going, look, people like that love basketball, you do not realize how good Larry Bird was. Like either like not even top 10, top five all time. Like he was that good. So I'll just watch these 10-minute videos of like Bird not taking his warm-up jersey off and like winning the three-point contest or being bored after scoring 50 points and just shooting lefty for the rest of the game, or telling people like, look, this is where I'm going to hit the winning shot from, and you cannot, there's nothing you can do to stop it. And then he would do it. Yeah. So that's, it's just been like, oh, so good. So good. So that's been a really good form of self-care. That and watching Murder, She Wrote with my wife.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Those are the three things I've been doing. So
bring me back to my 92 Dream Team moments, you know?
Oh yeah.
So, fun times.
For myself, so this is Memorial Day weekend, and because we didn't have to have a snow day, I work at a high school, and I'm a school counselor as well, and because we didn't have a snow day, we got Friday off, so we got a 4-day weekend for Memorial Day. So oh, I nice. Spent most of Friday watching Stranger Things.
yes, it's yeah. so good.
No spoilers.
I'm not gonna spoil anything. No, I have like I've started the last episode and I gotta finish it. Now I'm only gonna say one thing. I think I would have rather just more episodes instead of 70-minute episodes.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I agree.
Yeah.
It was warping my sense of time, you know.
Yeah. And the weird thing is go back to David Lynch. So Twin Peaks: The Return has a, oh, you're going to hear stuff in my house. Maybe anyway, sorry. Twin Peaks: The Return has a similar structure as this season does where we're going to be all over the place and eventually it'll all come together. So that was like, I felt myself being like, if I had not watched Twin Peaks: The Return, I don't know if I would have been as patient for this.
so it's like that Arrested Development season when it first.
Yes. Came yes. Back. No, you're totally. That is exactly what it's like. Yeah. Totally.
It's okay. Better than that because that.
Hopefully.
It
broke my heart.
Yeah. It does actually.
But no, I know what you mean. Yeah.
They learned from the mistakes on that. I'll say.
When
that.
Do you get out of school if you didn't have snow days? When do you get out?
I still get out in mid-June. We just would have had to go to work on Friday. Okay. Is the only thing. So because we didn't have a snow day, we got to take that day off instead. So.
June 28th for us.
June 28th.
The,
oh, man.
We had 3 days. October, where the power was out in like half of the Massachusetts.
Oh right, yeah. I do have a mantra for you.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So my colleague at my job, the other counselor in my building, she and I have been embracing the phrase "hope is a discipline," especially at this time right now. Mm-hmm. You know, so yes, it's sometimes it's hard to be hopeful, and sometimes it's you gotta discipline yourself to do it.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I've been doing for mental health is I'm trying to see how many days in a row I can go for a run.
Nice.
Yeah, nothing crazy, just like a half hour at most. So I've made it to 2 weeks and we'll see how long I can go. Nice. Usually I get to go like 3 or 4 times a week and I'm just making it happen.
Do like Jerry Seinfeld talks about like the 21-day chain of things or something. Yeah, yeah. Corey always, he's a big Seinfeld fan. Yeah. I like that hope is a discipline, and it was something that they were talking about in Dune. It was talking about Leto like cultivating this air of his like leadership, I believe, but that's interesting to think about like a discipline and like you are creating what you want your life to be for as much as control as you have. And I'm going to be using that because my kids are at home because we are out of school now. And so I'm like, oh my God, because I'm working from home and I've got 2 kids at home and their friends are in the house all the time. And they're all great. I love them all. But
is your house the house that all the kids go to, or do they go back and forth between all
of
them?
It's interchangeable. Okay. It just feels like when it's in my house that it's all the time and it will never end and that it's all the kids in the world. So, you know, but then it is nice to have my kids have a place to go. Yeah. So I guess that's the payoff. But well, we want to hear from you. What is the strangest body part you've ever found in a field? Have you ever sprayed pesticide all over someone else's kitchen? And what song would you like to sing in a nightclub? Or what is your grounding in self-care? Or what else is on your mind? You can answer all of these questions and more by following us at PsychoAPod on all the socials. You can also join our Facebook group, the Psychoanalysis Podcast Support Group. It's a private and moderated group where we can share about episode topics, mental health stuff, or anything else that's on your mind. And you can also email us at psychoapod@gmail.com if you want to share privately. And our homework question for the week, Mike had a very dirty one. But we're going to go ask with
it. I throw it out there.
Go for it. Yeah.
You want to know, listeners, and DM me directly. Just me.
Or voice recording, maybe?
Voice recording. I want your dirtiest, filthiest bedroom.
Mike's looking for some ideas. So
give it to me. All of it.
One, well, yeah. There's an example. Of what we're looking for. But the actual question is, what is the weirdest shit you got up to on a break from college? When you were home from college, what kind of wacky hijinks and capers did you get into?
And if that, it could involve dirty talk.
It could involve dirty talk. That's true.
It could involve dirty talk with me specifically.
We're not going to judge.
No, why not? I'm going to judge. Judge Judy is on. Yeah.
Uh-oh, is that your dirty talk? Judge Judy, is that a euphemism?
Can I tell a quick story?
Yeah.
When my wife and I were dating, I went a little bit aggressively for the boobs. And she kindly said, you have to, you know, you have to kind of excite them a little bit first before you can do anything. And I said, boobs, we're going to Disney World. And she was like, not like that.
And she just got up and just walked away.
Not like that. No, 16 years married this year.
I mean, that is... That's kind of funny.
18 years married. 16 years married. Fuck. Long time
math
married
is hard.
This June. Math is hard. Yeah. I have turned into Malibu Stacy.
The fact that you like said that particular thing within context of us talking about Blue Velvet, I immediately went to that scene where he's like...
Same.
Like he's like in the car when he's like, oh,
what
are these?
Don't look at me!
Like, like that.
Yeah, I'm sure yours sounds like it ended a little more happily.
It did.
Well, next up for us, speaking of things that maybe are not so happy, we're going back to our trigger warning, just trigger warning. We are concluding our series on suicide. Our previous episode was on Flatliners, and we are going to conclude this series with Pulse. So make sure you listen to our episode on Flatliners if you've not already, and watch Pulse. I believe it's on HBO Max right now.
It is.
And this is the, that's the, is that the Japanese one? Or
it is the Japanese one. Yes. Okay. Yes, the original Pulse.
Not the one with Kristen Bell. Okay.
No. If Kristen Bell shows up, then watch
the picked
the
wrong
one.
Movie. Okay.
Exactly. No. Yes, yes.
I saw that one in theaters because...
Well, you like Kristen her, right?
Bell. I love Kristen Bell.
I do like Kristen Bell, too. Yeah. The Good Place is fucking hilarious. All right. And so let's wrap up with some plugs. Andrew, where can we find you online? And what is coming up for the Dead Letter Movies podcast?
So you can just find me at deadlettermovies.com. I'm writing stuff at least once a month. That's like a thing I told myself I'm going to do. And so after we're done here, I got to do the rough draft before the month ends. So that'll be up in a couple of days, hopefully. Uh-huh. But we, Tim and I decided, we came up with our summer series, and it's going to be about, we're going to be going through, we haven't come up with a good title yet, but we're going to be going through 40 years of summer movies. So,
oh, fun!
Yeah, so he has not seen Poltergeist, so we're going to go all the way back to 82, and that's going to be, it'll probably be the first one. So yeah, that's, and I'm hoping to do like a sequel one where we like talk about Batman Returns and maybe Wrath of Khan and then things like that. Yeah.
Nice.
Nice.
Yeah,
so,
that sounds fun.
A lot to work, yeah.
And that, we will link that site, but it's deadlettermovies.com. Right?
Yeah.
And that's where your writing is going to?
That's where my writing goes to. His writing, awesome. Too, when he does it, yeah.
Oh, sweet. Yeah, so we'll link those in the show notes. And Mike, what's up for you?
So we finally, on Friday evening, and it's up now live, the long-awaited Jawbreaker versus Jawbreaker episode was recorded. I love recording with Jessica. She's such a welcome addition to the Pod and the Pendulum, my other show. We led off with Jessica talking about the movie Jawbreaker from 1999 and what a fun kind of like camp queer classic that is. And Jessica is such an awesome voice in film. I recommend you go to her site, wewhowalkhere.com. So we had a great talk on that. And then I basically did transform into that meme of the dude whispering and yelling in a girl's ear while she looks horrified as I talked about the greatest band to ever pick up guitars, Jawbreaker, from the early to mid 90s, and now reuniting, or have reunited since 2017. And it was great because Jessica, you know, took the playlist I made of them, and she's like, how the fuck did I miss this band when they were around? Because they're just so incredible. There were tears on my part at some points recording and talking about watching old videos of rooms I was in, watching them or other bands play, and realizing there are so many people in those rooms that I absolutely love to this day. And I don't think it was like a very in-depth, like you would not get a very in-depth feel of who the band was, you know, dissecting them from a critical standpoint as much as from a very emotional kind of like, here's what this band meant to me. And it's one of my favorite things we've ever recorded for that show. But the next episode after that, get it right, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Finally, and that's where we're going to be going over the summer of 2022. So fucking pumped to get into that, folks.
Yeah, those are very summery movies too.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Good times.
Very hot, very sweaty, yeah. Very smelly.
Just, and they're good, clean, fun. You know,
yeah, cool, I mean,
fun road movies. You know,
oh definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no hygiene.
On the back of my door in my office, I have a picture of, I discovered this thing called ominous positivity.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this picture, like I made this, it's Leatherface from the new movie, like holding up the face in the, like the promo image, yep. You could get really easily for the new movie. Yeah. And it says, it's important to feel comfortable in your own skin because it's illegal to wear someone else's. So I have that on like on the back of my door in my office, and kids only ever get to see it when I like shut it. And it's I also have a picture of Samara from The Ring crawling out that says, "This is the being in the well, reminding you to take care of your well-being." So just, you know,
excellent,
fun things.
Yeah. I've got nice.
The Evil Dead and American Werewolf in London posters in the back of the door, and the blister pack of the Grady twins from The Shining.
Nice.
And like there's one young woman who's totally freaked out by those, and I've told her, listen, if you don't stop stirring up drama, I'm gonna have it so wherever, whatever class you're in, like these will be in the seat right in front of you.
Uh-huh.
So knock it off. And, and she actually is kind of cut the drama a lot in the past month. So
she's like, I'll make
motivation
sure
is motivation
yes. Right. Well, you can find me at Jim Ferratu on Twitter and Instagram. You can also find me co-hosting the Losers Club podcast, which is a podcast about Stephen King. And we just talked to Stephen King.
That was so
which
cool.
Blew my fucking mind. I know when I heard that was actually going to happen, I was speechless. Like I'm very rarely speechless. But yeah, so that was really cool. But yeah, and you can also find me co-hosting the White Ladies in Crisis podcast, and Physical is back, and it's good, and Tyler is back, speaking of Evil Dead, who is Joe Tyler Pucci in the new one, and I just have a huge crush on, and I just love him, and it makes me want to do aerobics, so check that out also, but you can find all that stuff by following me. That's me, and that's our episode on Blue Velvet. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for bringing this movie. Thank you for the depth of conversation that we had with this. It's a lot, but I feel like I'm glad we went there for some of it too. So yeah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. And Laura, I'm sorry for all the things we didn't say.
Oh, yeah.
When she listens to this, she's going to be yelling a lot. But
we might have to attack Laura rebuttal onto the end. Come back anytime. We love talking to you about movies, especially Lynch, because you can listen to us. Listeners, thank you so much for spending time with us. Please make sure to take care of yourselves and take care of each other. And with that, let's sign off. We came here to chew bubblegum and take care of ourselves. And we are
all out of bubblegum. But we have nitrous.
Don't look at me!